Hello, and welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. My name is Brandon J. Fedor, and I'm your host. This week, I spoke with Nicholas DeVillers about his book, Opacity in the Closet, Queer Tactics in Foucault, Barthes, and Warhol. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will too. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. DeVillers about his book, Opacity in the Closet, Queer Tactics in Foucault, Barthes, and Warhol. Dr. DeVillers, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Okay, if you could just maybe give us a brief sort of outline of your biography.
Sure. I was born in Boston. My mother is British and my father is South African. So that's why I pronounce my last name DeVillers. And actually, though, I was at a French studies conference where they corrected the spelling of my first name. They dropped the H to make it look more French, Nicolas de Villiers, because they assumed that it was French. So I pass as French on paper, but it's a South African name. And so I was born in Boston. I went to Simon's Rock College of Bard for my associate's degree for undergrad, and then transferred to Bard College, where that was where I first got interested in queer theory. And in fact, I wrote my bachelor's thesis on queer discursive strategies in film. And the case studies were the Alfred Hitchcock film Rope, the Tom Kalin film Swoon, Paris is Burning, The Crying Game, John Waters films, and my favorite was Pee Wee Herman. So I was lucky to be able to, it was a literature program, but to be able to write about film and cultural studies. So that's what got me interested in applying to grad school for a cultural studies program. So I got my MA and my PhD in comparative studies and discourse and society from the University of Minnesota. And I continued to pursue queer theory there, but also immersed myself in what many people now are calling French theory. Derrida, Deleuze, Foucault, Blanchot, Lacan, and Barthes. And in fact, I don't know if you've read François Cousset's book, French Theory, but it's this very uncanny feeling to read that book. It's like the Roberta Flack song, Killing Me Softly, that you just feel like he's describing exactly the kind of flourishing of French theory in the American Academy. So so that was one of the things that I really immersed myself in and really liked at Minnesota. And my mentors there were John Mowat and Cesare Caterino, Gary Thomas, and Liz Coates. And Liz Coates especially encouraged me in my thinking about Warhol and language. She got a seminar on Andy Warhol. But while I was at Minnesota, I was also an instructor, and I often taught a course called Gay Men and Homophobia in American Culture. And in that course, I taught Eve Sedgwick, along with Foucault and Barthes. And that course actually allowed me to work out some of the limitations of the metaphor of the closet, as it is often applied retroactively to historical figures, with the assumption that anyone who doesn't come out must be ashamed or be it must be a symptom of internalized homophobia. So in that course and in my own thinking, I wanted to follow Foucault in placing coming out of the closet within the overall history of the putting into discourse of sex, of confessional discourse, which in History of Sexuality, Volume 1, Foucault charts through the Christian confessional to the psychiatrist's couch. But I think now, in fact, confessional discourse has really spread, especially in new media, online, etc. So I wanted to place the closet within this this history of confessional discourse, but also look at the closet as, in particular, involving kind of double binds for the subject regarding what is considered public, what is considered private. And I wanted to reevaluate the urge that people have to designate a person as in or out of the closet and to take seriously the resistance to confessional discourse. And also following Foucault, the multiple meanings of both speech and silence about sexuality. So to consider that the refusal to tell the secret of one's sexuality is not necessarily synonymous with shame or complicit with homophobia. So I wrote my dissertation, which was called Opacity's Queer Strategies, on the possibility of creating a queer public persona that might resist both homophobia and the confessional or the closet. So the figures that I looked at in the dissertation were Michel Foucault, Roland Barthes, and Andy Warhol, and also at the genres that are typically associated with confession and authenticity, namely diaries, interviews, memoirs, documentaries. So Opacity in the Closet is a revised and expanded version of that work. And where I expanded was more on the historical context, looking at the emergence of gay liberation and the demand to come out, but also at the context of changes in journalism, especially the pop art celebrity interview and the intellectual celebrity interview. It sounds strange to say, but you know, I want to look at book shows where Foucault and Barthes were asked to talk about their work. What I also expanded on in this book is my own relationship to archives, since a lot of the work was completed. A lot of the research was completed at archives at INEC, which is l'Institut Mémoire de l'Édition Contemporaine in France. That's where the Foucault archives are. At the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, which is the National Library, and at the Warhol archives in Pittsburgh at the Andy Warhol Museum, which is where the time capsules are kept. And that's actually the cover image of the book. I don't know if you have the book in front of you, but the cover images of the Warhol time capsules.
Oh, interesting.
And so what Warhol kept in these time capsules was basically his mailings, invitations, and especially press clippings. But looking over this image, I was really struck by also this strange sense of a lack of hierarchy in terms of these ephemera. So one of the boxes just says gems and junk, and another one says newspaper headlines. So that was one of the things I really enjoyed was being at the Warhol Museum and getting to look at the contents of these time capsules, and also to listen to the tape recordings. There's so many tape recordings that Warhol kept. Some of them that went into the making of the books, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol and Popism, but he also just tape recorded almost constantly his conversations and the life of the factory. So I was very happy to be able to use that image for the cover of the book. And then just to tell you where I am currently, I'm at the University of North Florida, and I teach English and film. And I've been lucky enough to be able to teach some of my research. I've taught seminars on Roland Barthes and on Andy Warhol, and a graduate course called Sex, Confession, and Autobiography, in which we look at the history of confessional discourse and contemporary forms, things like blogs and post-secret talk shows, etc., as new media versions of confessional discourse.
Oh, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
I might have to ask for a syllabus from that.
Yeah, I'm happy to share it.
Okay. As a way to sort of transition into our discussion of the book, I know you wanted to speak about Foucault, Barthes, and Warhol, but I was wondering if maybe you could elaborate a little bit on the notion of opacity that you discussed in the introduction, because I think it's really fascinating and it'll kind of help the listeners sort of understand the rest of the discussion.
Yeah. So I intend opacity to be basically the opposite of transparency, if we insist that someone be transparent. It's related to the metaphor of the closet of kind of trying to see past someone and look at the hidden secret. So as a concept, opacity is a way of naming something that is visible but opaque and on the surface, rather than transparent or see-through. And I'm in particular critical of the desire to see past the image presented by the subject. There's a kind of desire at all costs to imagine that we can see through them to uncover some hidden secret.
Okay. I thought that was really interesting. Towards the end of the introduction, you were talking about sort of the paranoia that like Marxism and psychoanalysis kind of have trained us to approach a text with, And you talk about the sort of surface reading that Sharon Marcus, I forget who else you mentioned.
Sharon Marcus and Stephen Best. And you know, I'm really encouraged by this trend of maybe rethinking the approach to uncovering the hidden meaning of a work.
Mm-hmm.
And they relate it to the hermeneutics of suspicion, which distrusts appearances and, you know, seeks a hidden meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also related to later work by Eve Sedgwick, where she makes a distinction between what she calls paranoid reading and reparative reading. And she argues that paranoid reading really places its faith in exposure. And she says that there's really limitations to that approach. I think Ray Chow also says very interesting things about surface reading, in particular in the case of film. So I want to basically contribute to that that approach, this trend of surface reading.
Hmm. Okay, well, Dr. DeVillers, if you'd like to sort of talk about the three authors in particular that you outline in the book,
sure.
I think that would be good.
Sure. So what motivated me to write about them together, about Foucault, Barthes, and Warhol together, is not only their shared historical context, but also the fact that they're hugely influential to our thinking about sexuality and subjectivity, and yet none of them directly came out in the way that we now expect and demand such public figures to do. And what I want to look at is how they responded to that growing demand. And I wasn't satisfied to write them off as closeted. In fact, I think each of them offers a very thoughtful resistance to the workings of confessional discourse and the closet. And so I wanted to look at their self-reflexive writing rather than importing a kind of ill-fitting framework or metaphor or model to understand them.
Mm.
So I also wanted to put them in dialogue with one another, to use them to read each other, which allowed me to not be entirely limited to speculating about the author's intentions, especially because in their cases, it's especially ironic that, you know, Foucault and the theory of discourse that he put forward and the essay, What is an Author? Roland Barthes, the author of The Death of the Author, or Warhol, who many consider to have killed off the artist as the sole originator of the meaning of the work, it would be too ironic to only insist on following their intentions. So I also look at how their personas were collaborative and the way that their personas have taken on a life after their deaths.
Hmm.
But I am skeptical or wary of the posthumous effort to make them confess, whereby homosexuality is understood as a secret that needs to be uncovered by the critic. And there's a kind of knowing way in which that's done. And so I'm in particular inspired by Eve Sedgwick's analysis of what she calls knowingness, which is this privileged and sort of presumed knowingness of authority, whereby we imagine that we know a secret about someone. So the example that I start with is of this kind of knowingness on behalf of a critic and a biographer is James Miller's The Passion of Michel Foucault. And Miller reads all of Foucault's work as what he calls an implicit confession of Foucault's obsession with sex and death. And really that obsession is more properly James Miller's own. And I agree with David Halperin in Saint Foucault. There's a chapter called The Describable Life of Michel Foucault, which looks at this problem of straight biographers writing about queer biographical subjects in a way that makes them into an object of knowingness, whereby the queer biographical subject is always at a disadvantage. And I was also really struck by Miller's kind of revenge against Foucault's resistance to confession by arguing, despite his efforts, you know, Foucault ended up confessing. And I was reminded of a passage from The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, where Foucault says that the confession has spread its effects so far and wide that, you know, one confesses or is forced to confess. So it seemed to me that Miller was actually forcing Foucault to confess despite his resistance. Mm. The other problem that I had with that biography is the way that for Miller, Foucault's death from AIDS-related illness was seen as a kind of shaming secret that was revealed after Foucault's death. And so to counteract that, or to offset that, I wanted to look at a dialogue or to create a dialogue between Foucault's late interviews in which he talks about homosexuality and friendship and connect those to put those in conversation with a novel by his friend Hervé Guibert called To the Friend Who Did Not Save My Life. And the narrator of Guibert's book is particularly aware of the problem of betrayal of the Foucault character. It's fictionalized. The character's name is Neville. And so he's hyper-aware. He's keenly aware of this problem of betrayal, but also feels justified in writing about his friend's illness, about Neville's illness, because he feels that they share the same fate, that they share the fate of seropositivity. And so I wanted to look at the queer temporality of that friendship that emerges between the two of them. And that's something that Eve Sedgwick discusses in Touch and Feeling. And it's also something that that one of my cohorts at University of Minnesota, one of my graduate cohorts and friends, Tom Roach, something he discusses in his book that just came out called Friendship as a Way of Life, which takes its title from the late Foucault interview called Friendship as a Way of Life. So both Sedgwick and Roach and I hope to contribute to this thinking about queer temporality in relationship to friendship and to AIDS. So that's part of the theoretical framework that I use. And also, I think that's a kind of a reparative reading that I want to offer of Foucault and Foucault's friendship with Guibert. So the theoretical framework of the book, I am very influenced by early Sedgwick, by Epistemology of the Closet, and the deconstruction of the binaries of the closet. But I'm also very inspired by that distinction that she makes between paranoid reading and reparative reading. And that actually helps me, Sedgwick's sort of self-critique, where she looks at her own early work in terms of its paranoid tone. And she also looks at the work of her contemporaries very foundational figures in queer theory, Judith Butler and D.A. Miller, and their shared faith in exposure and some of the limitations of that approach. So that helped me with addressing in the chapter on Roland Barthes the book written by D.A. Miller called Bringing Out Roland Barthes, which is very well-intentioned in its desire to bring out, Miller says, you know, he's going to be bringing out both himself and that. And that's related to Guibert and Foucault, that Guibert is speaking both about himself and about Foucault. But what struck me is that Miller, D.A. Miller, in Bringing Out Roland Barthes, has a somewhat condescending tone whereby Barthes is seen as closeted and as unwilling to speak the name of homosexuality. And so it was related to the dissatisfaction that I felt towards James Miller on Foucault with this posthumous treatment of Barthes as an object of pity. And I wonder why it is that Roland Barthes has a strangely peripheral status in queer theory. And I wonder if that's maybe a paradoxical effect of viewing him as closeted, that if we accept that coming out of the closet is a speech act, if it's performative, then I ask, is it possible that declaring that someone is closeted might be performative, whether it has the effect of forever closeting them and making them actually less available for a queer reading on their own terms? So both Miller and I look at a preface that Roland Barthes wrote to a novel by Renaud Camus called Tricks, And it's basically a novel about gay cruising. And the preface is a really beautiful, very short piece, but I think Barthes says a great deal about his own critique of identity politics, of the limitations of identity politics. So he uses the preface as an opportunity, in fact, to weigh in on the issue of coming out or of declaring homosexuality as an identity. And what he admires in Camus' novel is what he calls a certain way of saying I. And he argues that it's particular to literature, and that within Camus' book, that homosexuality is not presented as a topic for debate. And this really spoke to me because I think homosexuality is still presented as a topic for debate in, you know, the press, in various debates that we have over gay marriage, gays in the military, etc. But I like Barthes' suggestion that that in fact in Camus there is what he calls a form of silence that consists of speaking simply. And the phrase that he gives us is that Camus' novel speaks homosexuality, but it never speaks about it. It never makes it into a topic. So the contemporary example that I can think of, it's kind of a pop culture, pop media example, is the two Bravo shows, Project Runway and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, especially the first season of Project Runway. I don't know if you have you seen either of those shows.
Yeah, I have actually.
Okay, yeah. So, so the distinction that I make is Project Runway. In the first season, none of the designers. It's this, you know, designer competition show. Come out directly, that there's not a kind of what we expect from reality TV, which is them explaining their, you know, when they first realized they were gay or something like that, or when they first came out to their family. Whereas in Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, the show is really relentlessly about the gay identities of these makeover consultants. And so it speaks exhaustively about homosexuality as a topic. And what I would say is that I don't think that that therefore means, in comparison, that Project Runway is closeted. In fact, I think that it speaks homosexuality at many points through very flaming kind of camp dialogue, but it doesn't speak about it in the way that we expect of the kind of coming out narrative. And actually, that analogy, this example, was ruined by the later seasons of Project Runway, in which there is a much more perfunctory coming out that is expected of a designer. So that's my example of a contemporary example where I think that Barthes' distinction is useful between speaking homosexuality versus speaking about it, making it into a topic for debate. So Miller is skeptical of Roland Barthes' preface and of this assertion that that's possible, that this form of silence that consists of saying things, speaking simply. So he argues that it collapses back into the closet pretty easily. But I think Miller ends up overvaluing homophobia. I think he ends up only understanding Barthes and Camus in the terms of homophobia. But Barthes actually suggests a concept of silence that is much more nuanced, that it's not the same thing as censorship or hiding or shaming. And so that suggestion that silence is actually a form of speech, or that form of silence that consists of speaking simply, saying things simply, I relate to something that Foucault also says in History of Sexuality, Volume 1, where he argues that silences function alongside the things that are said. And both early Sedgwick and early Miller read that passage from Foucault as an example of the closet, that the closet is an example of performative silence that speaks. But both Foucault and Barthes offer much more positive readings of silence and its relationship to speech. And that comes through especially in the late Foucault interviews and in Barthes' courses at the Collège de France, especially the neutral, where he's very interested in positive versions of silence rather than being silenced in some sort of oppressive or censoring way.
I'll have to say that I really did love that distinction that you kind of draw out, the speaking simply.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like it's sort of, because I mean, I've been frustrated in just in the little, you know, the little work that I have done in queer theory and the reading I've done, you know, about the symbol of the closet and how that idea of speaking simply sort of gives us a way to kind of move past that binary, the in and out, inside the closet,
outside
the closet.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting.
And that's,
when you talk about Foucault and his notions of silence, about how, you know, silence could mean an entire range of things. He talks about love, you know, being able to sense.
Yeah, love and friendship as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
I'm glad to hear that it's helpful as a way maybe out of this binary of being in and out, and that's really something that actually late Sedgwick and late Roland Barthes share is an interesting non-dualistic way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Foucault's, you know, idea that silence can function alongside the things that are said. His phrase is that the discourses are tactically polyvalent, but I think that silence is polyvalent, that it can work in multiple directions, some of which are repressive and some of which are not. So rather than viewing homosexuality as something that is silenced or unnameable in Roland Barthes, I wanted to look at what I see as his queer ethics of what he calls a suspension of meaning, which isn't the same thing as just refusal to acknowledge meaning. Which is actually, that's the point of connection between Roland Barthes and Andy Warhol, that both of them were very interested in operations to empty out meaning. In the case of Warhol, it was through repetition that he argued that the more you see something, the more it loses its meaning. And the phrase that he gives us is wonderfully enigmatic, is the better and emptier you feel. But I think that both Barthes and Warhol were interested in this possibility of emptying out meaning and also of displacing authenticity, the obsession with authenticity. So Barthes was interested in experimenting with different ways of saying I, in part something that he explains in that preface to Camus, but ways that are not the same thing as straightforward autobiography. And so he looks at various forms, he experiments with various forms, the fragment, what he calls the novelesque. And especially in his most self-reflexive book, Roland Barthes, there's a suggestion. The opening line is that all of it should be considered as if spoken by a character in the novel. And that actually relates back to something in the Guibert. Guibert was also very interested in autofiction. In the idea of fictionalizing one's life, in transforming one's journals, one's diaries, into a work of fiction. And so Barthes also experimented with the journal form in Incidents and Paris Evenings, which were both published posthumously in the collection Incidents. And those texts describe his relationships with young men in Morocco and in Paris. And I don't necessarily read them as revelations of the secret of his sexuality, which was somehow discreetly hidden from the world, only to be revealed after his death. And the fact that Roland Barthes' death was an accident also complicates things, that there's a tone of finality to these later posthumously published texts. But and it's also, it represents kind of ethical problems for his editors about publishing this material. But I'm very glad that these texts were published posthumously, in part because of the light that they shed on Barthes' attitude, not towards homosexuality as something that should be hidden, but especially in the courses, the courses taught at the Collège de France, the Neutral, and most recently the Preparation of a Novel. In fact, Barthes treats homosexuality as commonplace, as something that is easily recognizable to his listeners. And as the way that the course has worked at the Collège de France, it was an open audience of the public. And I think he treats homosexuality as exoteric rather than some esoteric thing. Mm. But in the neutral, especially the course on the neutral, he is wary of journalism and of what he sees as the aggressive attempt of journalists to ferret out the sexuality of the subject. So he puts forward this idea of the neutral as a way of sidestepping the demand to pick a side. So back to what you were saying about avoiding a binary way of thinking, that whole course is about a kind of third term or an alternative to a binary of being in or out, for instance. So that possibility of a neutral is something that he expresses a very strong desire for. But he also acknowledges that the neutral is often seen as cowardly, or that there's lots of negative images of the neutral as somehow quietist or complicit. But for him, it's a very strong and positive term, this idea of avoiding what may be a kind of dead end or mug's game debate. So the example I can think of, a contemporary one, would be the debate over whether homosexuality is innate or acquired, the nature versus nurture debate. And both Bach and Foucault refused to get into that debate. In fact, in an interview, Foucault was asked, do you think that homosexuality is innate or acquired? Do you think it's nature or nurture? And he just said, no comment. And I don't think he was not being courageous. I think that he says it's because not everybody's being asked and I don't want to abuse my authority. But I think it's also potentially a dead end, that debate. In part, it's a dead end because as long as we focus on that question of whether homosexuality is innate or acquired, whether it's nature or nurture, we can't ask questions about gay rights now in the present. I think it's necessary to step back from the debate and point out that it's only in homophobic society that we are obsessed with finding out what caused homosexuality. So I think the neutral, being neutral in that debate, also allows us to step back and consider the terms of the debate and whether it is a fruitful one or not. So Warhol also interested me in this, in his desire for a kind of neutral position. So his interview strategies oftentimes involve being neutral and turning around the situation of the interview, especially if turning around aggressive questions. So in those interviews that thankfully now have all been collected, many of them have been collected in I'll Be Your Mirror, the selected Andy Warhol interviews. But what you notice in his interviews is that he often ends up turning the situation around, which is why I like that title, I'll Be Your Mirror, because the interviewer ends up saying far more about themselves, about their own fear of being put on by Warhol or their fear of being put on by pop art. So they reveal more about themselves rather than Warhol telling them how they should interpret his artwork or how they should interpret his image. So that inspired me to be always more curious about the motives of the interviewer or the biographer or the critic, rather than assuming that the subject should be faulted for not coming out directly. So rather than putting the subject on trial, and I think there are some homologies between the interviewer and the trial. I think I want to follow a suggestion that Roland Barthes makes actually in an interview where he says, I want to put the interview on trial. I want to look at why the interview has such a dominant position within media culture and the way in which it functions. So in the case of Warhol and his critics and his interviewers, they're often very frustrated by Warhol's alleged silence. And they're completely unwilling to take Warhol's statements at face value. So the most famous ones that you've probably heard even before you read the book is Warhol's famous for saying, I want to be a machine. Mm-hmm. And the other one, which was actually when the U.S. Post Office had an Andy Warhol commemorative stamp. They used this quote on the sheet of stamps, which is, if you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings and films and me, and there I am. There's nothing behind it. So what I look at, especially with that quote, is the fact that so many critics refuse to take Warhol at his word. That they insist, of course, there's something behind it. There's got to be some hidden intention. There's got to be some hidden meaning. He can't be serious. That if we want to know about him, we should look at the surface. So what I wanted to do is to actually to take him at his word, and to value that opacity, that rather than the demand to see through him, looking for some hidden depths. Which is why I include and I spend so much time on that Duane Michael's portrait of Warhol, where Warhol is covering his face with both hands. And the immediate tendency is to say that Warhol's hiding, that we read it as hide and seek, you know, that seems to be what the gesture is. And I look at the mention of that photograph in Bart's Camerasita, where, in fact, Bart reads it as not hiding anything. He says, to me, Warhol hides nothing, because what he offers to be read is his hands. So that's an example of looking at the surface, looking at the something that's visible but opaque, and not trying to look past it, not seeing it as a metaphor somehow for Warhol hiding the secret. So I'm very, very happy that I was granted permission to reproduce that photograph. It can be very difficult to reproduce photographs. So I was very happy that Duane Michaels and his gallery were willing to grant permission, because I really like Bart's reading of it, and I think it's a helpful visual example of a different reading practice of how do you sort of change the habit of thinking that would only approach it as an example of Warhol hiding something. And the other habit of thinking that I wanted to challenge about Warhol is the assumption that Warhol was silent, that he was always silent. In fact, he doesn't seem to me to be always silent. And so I wanted to look at Warhol's books and his diary as instances where Warhol does have a very distinctive style of speaking. Not only in the interviews, there's the distinctive kind of monosyllabic yes, no, maybe, haven't really thought about it, which I compare in the book to the Magic 8-Ball, where it's like yes, no, try again later. but that's him at his most monosyllabic, at his most basic. But in fact, in popism and the philosophy of Andy Warhol, there's much more of an interest in memoir, in cultural memoir, in the aphorism, in fragmentary kind of philosophical forms. So I wanted to really look at Warhol as a writer and not assume that he's silent. But what I discovered in popism and in the philosophy of Andy Warhol, and also in these interviews, is that Warhol is much more collaborative in the way that he speaks. So oftentimes he'll allow other people to speak for him as a kind of proxy. And in fact, he saw his image as a collage of all the things that were said about him. So that's why, again, looking back at the cover image of the time capsules, that's why press clippings were so important, is that in fact that was the truth of Warhol's image, was this collage of all the things that were said about him. And there's a similar passage in the philosophy of Andy Warhol that was, in fact, collaboratively written with Pat Hackett and with Bob Colicello, in which Warhol lists all the things that are said about him and about his image while looking in a mirror. And so that is the truth, he argues, of who he is. So Warhol's artwork and his interviews, to me, they say a lot more about how the media work and less about Warhol's own individual obsessions or pathologies. Having said that, it's clear that there is still a very strong desire for tell-all books that promise to reveal some private or hidden aspect of Warhol. The publishing industry has not stopped at all at these tell-alls. about these figures. But yeah, for me, Warhol...
Sorry. Well, I was just thinking about that. And I was coming up with this question in my mind that you were talking about the publishing industry and the tell-alls. And I mean, you talk about this a little bit more generally about how, I mean, that and like Foucault's talked about this, about how that's like a societal tendency. Like we want to know, you know, we want to, to ferret this information out. And, you know, I was trying to think while I was reading the book about how sort of the notion of opacity fits into like larger society, because on one side I feel like it's, you know, it's definitely an attempt to give, to provide some agency, like we said earlier, to provide a way out, like a third term. And I just wonder like how it fits into the larger sort of scheme of society where larger society, they want to know that information. And so like silence has been seen as passivity and like the sin of omission, like you mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
Somewhere. I'm just curious about that and what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I in terms of contemporary examples of that might test out this theory, I was really actually happy to discover that a graduate student at the University of Illinois on a blog about Anderson Cooper coming out used my book to frame the problem.
Oh, wow.
Which was that many people saw Anderson Cooper's closet, if there was one, as a kind of glass closet. I mean, Gawker and a couple sites were really obsessed with trying to expose him. Getting a picture of him and his boyfriend. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he wasn't really in the closet either. And so one way of approaching it would be what Sedgwick calls knowingness, which is, you know, we all know this secret, but that maintains a certain degree of privilege over the subject. And those Gawker exposés were like, you know, would try to catch little slips. And so that's one approach. But I think that Anderson Cooper's idea of, well, as a journalist, and I was never ashamed of it, but this was not something that I thought was an important thing to put out there, that many people had a hard time believing that and so he said, I realized that it could be mistaken for shame, and so that's why I decided to come out, is because I didn't want people to assume that this is something I thought was shameful about. And a lot of people responded by, you know, he came out in an email to Andrew Sullivan, and a lot of people responded by saying, it's so classy the way that he came out. And I actually, I really like, there's a podcast called Throwing Shade with Brian Sassi and Aaron Gibson, and they kind of make fun of that idea that there's classy ways to come out. It's called Throwing Shade. Throwing Shade. It's a podcast. They give examples, parodying the idea of a classy coming out, where they say the classiest way to come out is to come out to a Kennedy, to come out on a yacht, to come out to Ina Garten in the Hamptons. So they're pretty, you know, I appreciate their sarcasm about this idea that there are classy ways to come out. But at the same time, I respect the double bind that I think Anderson Cooper was in. Mm-hmm. And so there are other examples. I mean, when the astronaut Sally Ride, after her death, it was revealed that she was lesbian, that she had a long-term partner who, in fact, doesn't have full rights of inheritance. And the question was, did she keep it a secret? Was it a sign of her shame, or was this a question of how she negotiated her public image? And so I think there are lots of other examples of that, that's why I think, rather than necessarily judging the figure, I think it's helpful to think strategically or tactically. Mm-hmm. And so, again, part of the theoretical framework of the book is using this concept of strategies and tactics. And Foucault, I think, is very helpful. David Halperin argues that Foucault is very helpful for thinking about homophobia and homophobic discourse and how it can be resisted strategically rather than necessarily refuted logically point by point, that it's more useful to resist it strategically. But I also like the distinction that Michel de Certeau makes between strategies and tactics. So de Certeau argues that strategies are made from the position of authority and property. So his analogy is that there's, you know, marketing strategies, corporations have strategies, whereas consumers have tactics which are much more on the fly and depend on the situation. They're a matter of seizing an opportunity. So I think that Warhol, especially the Warhol interviews, can be understood tactically in terms of, at this given moment, what can I do with the format of the interview, the assumptions about me. And Bart also insisted that it was more important for him to think tactically about a given problem of meaning at a given moment. So I think rather than necessarily judging a person for being closeted, I think it's more interesting to try to account for their both overall strategy with regard to managing their identity, and also the tactics at what particular moment is it right to come out in this particular way. So I think Anderson Cooper is an interesting example of that, of thinking about the particular historical context and therefore tactically deciding that it's necessary to come out. But again, I think the mandate to come out that therefore means that anyone who doesn't come forward is viewed as closeted, as ashamed of themselves. I think that that's also an unfortunate overgeneralization.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I really found your book fascinating in the way you sort of talk about Foucault, because when I was in grad school, I remember, you know, everyone I think goes through that phase where they're into Foucault a lot when you first discover Foucault. And I had a professor who said, you know, people were really frustrated with Foucault, you know, like his contemporaries, like you'd be like French society, general culture, because he was so silent. And I mean, Foucault's work is so political, you know, and his silence about his own homosexuality, about homosexual rights, was so frustrating to people. And I've read things about Foucault, I've read biographies, but I've never come across a book like yours before that really kind of tackles that issue head on in the way that you did. And I really appreciated that. I felt like I kind of came away with it with a much deeper understanding of Foucault and a better appreciation for the way he handled the situation.
Yeah, that's very nice to hear. I also emphasize the History of Sexuality, Volume 1,
mm-hmm.
Those who were really frustrated with Foucault, even Sedgwick herself in Touching Feeling and in the most recently posthumously published The Weathering Proust, faults Foucault for basically trapping himself in a corner with regard to the repressive hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an unfair view of him, and I think it's equally unfair to argue that he was silent in a shameful way, which many of his contemporaries after he died said that Foucault's silence on the issue of homosexuality was the sign of, it wasn't an intellectual silence, it was the sign of someone who's ashamed. But I think that that's not necessarily true if you look at the interviews that he gave to the gay press, for instance, gay PA interviews that he does. So at the end of The Monarchy of Sex, there's an interview called Sexual Choice, Sexual Act, and that interview on friendship as a way of life. In fact, he does talk very specifically about contemporary gay culture in a way that in which he includes himself. But I think he was wary of plotting out a particular course for gay liberation, of abusing his position as a prominent intellectual figure. But he was wary of that assumption that intellectuals should tell people what they should do politically. So that's something that he really explores in those interviews. And so the other reason why I think it's kind of unfair to say that Foucault trapped himself is that, in fact, the second and third volumes of The History of Sexuality represent an attempt to think beyond the repressive framework. And this is something that's also been discussed by David Halperin, this refuting this idea that Foucault trapped himself in his theory of power, and by Deleuze in Deleuze's book, Foucault. So I think that that's really the interest that I have is in these interviews and in the later works as ways to respond to those critics who see Foucault as flawed or as shamefully silent on homosexuality. I just don't think that that's true in terms of the interview. But I'm glad to hear that it can encourage people to look at those interviews.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I really like in those late interviews is the idea that Foucault suggests of the self as a work of art, and his argument that we should consider the writer's real work as the self in the process of writing. And he says that this is more productive than evaluating an author in terms of their authenticity or disauthenticity or unauthenticity. So to view the self as a performative effect of language. So that's something that I think has a great many implications for both the figures that I discuss in the book and for thinking about a writer's relationship to their homosexuality.
Well, Dr. DeVillers, it's been really great talking to you. I think we've taken up enough of your time, but I wonder, as maybe sort of a way to close our conversation, if you could speak a little bit about what you're currently working on.
Sure. So actually, a colleague and friend of mine said that he read my book and thought that the case study chapters on Foucault and Bauten and Warhol didn't fully exhaust the concept of opacity put forward in the introduction. And I took that as a good thing, that the case studies didn't exhaust the concept. So because it means that there's more directions that I can take the concept of opacity in and that others can take the concept in. So I mentioned already this blog in which someone used it to frame the problem of Anderson Cooper coming out. So it's exciting to see that it has this kind of immediate utility in terms of contemporary problems. But also in the introduction, I in discussing this idea of the self as a work of art that could be enacted or fictionalized, I mentioned a few other authors, Jean Genet, Yukio Mishima, and Samuel Delaney among them. And so I've gone on to write about Samuel Delaney and look at his self-reflexive memoirs and a documentary that was made in collaboration with him by Fred Barney Taylor called The Polymath, or The Life and Opinions of Samuel R. Delaney, Gentleman. And so I've published on that in Jump Cut and in a pedagogy journal called Transformations. So there I look at the intersectional identity of Delaney as a Black gay writer. And this is a way of moving further beyond the closet as a raceless paradigm. That's the critique made by Marlon Ross, that one of the other major problems with the closet is that it doesn't account for race. So my work on Delaney was a way of working that out. And I've also continued to publish on Paris is Burning, the documentary, and looking at the queer Black and Latino subjects of that documentary and how they relate ironically to the interview format and work to actually destabilize some of the assumptions of the ethnographic documentary. So I think that opacity as a concept could be very useful for thinking about drag and for thinking about transgender and transsexuality, and possible critiques of the narrative of coming out as transgender. So I think that that's another avenue that this could be taken in. In fact, I remember presenting an early version of the introduction on opacity's queer strategies at a conference in California and getting an email from Jacob Hale, who said that the concept of opacity would be very useful for thinking about trans narratives. So I think that's definitely a potential, both for myself and for others to work on. My next book project is a study of relations among confessional discourse, cinema vérité, and documentary form. So I look at a series of ethnographic documentaries about sex work. So the cases are Pasolini's film Love Meetings, a film by a Czech director, Victor Grodecký, called Body Without Soul, a film by Shohini Ghosh called Tales of the Night Fairies, about efforts by sex workers to unionize in West Bengal, and a film by a Beijing filmmaker, Freida M., called Night Scene, which also looks at sex workers in Beijing, but it's kind of a pseudo-documentary, parts of it are fictionalized in a really interesting way. So in this new book project, I look at issues that are related to opacity in the closet, namely the constraints and double binds that are placed on queer and marginalized interviewed subjects. And I want to perform a similar move of questioning the motives of the interviewer and the audience and the documentary filmmaker, rather than necessarily questioning the motives of the subjects themselves, these queer and marginalized sex worker subjects. So that's basically the next book project that I'm working
on. Well, that sounds fascinating. Do you have a pub date for that yet, or is that still in the early stages?
I don't, but okay. I've talked about it with the editor at University of Minnesota Press, and I was very happy to find that he was receptive and interested. So I'll let you know.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating.
Good.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and reading your book.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Nicholas DeVillers, and I hope you join me next time when my guest will be Stacey Alimo, and we'll be speaking about her book, Bodily Natures, Science, Environment, and the Material Self.